developed actually with Pathfinder. You know, the Sojourner that was riding around with Pathfinder, they started it with a web, warm electronic box, heavily insulated, very careful on how to bring the wires in and out because they even get cold. And there are a lot of the heat, the residual heat from the RTG, the radioisotope thermal electric generators. Yeah, they produce 103 watts, but at the same time, there's heat that's coming off there, maybe 1,200 watts, and that's enough to keep the rover going year-round. You know, when Opportunity and Spirit got into their winters, they kind of, you know, just stay there. They would park it on the side, on a slope, where the solar rays were facing the sun. And they would kind of go to rest for 6 months, not quite 6 months, but, you know, along, you know, the winter time. This rover and 2020 rover won't have to do that. Let me drop it. The European Space Agency's rover, by the way, is going to be similar to Spirit and Opportunity in that respect. It's going to be solar operated. I don't know. I know you asked something else, but that went out of my head. 2018, yes, that's what he plans on doing. And if he can't make that window, of course, I'm sure to shoot for 2020. But, this crew version has been under development for quite a long time now. And, again, I actually saw a test of the crew version. Draco, Super Draco rockets go off. He had it suspended from a crane, and they launched for about 7 or 8 seconds, enough to give it some lift. And he was testing that. That's the crude version. So it's well under development. He's got a lot of things going at the same time. Back to you, John.
Chicken Dick.
Okay, John recognized. Back to you, John. KC2WGB. K2IW.
KC2WGB. Dick, if you know, what's the inclination of Mars orbit compared to the ecliptic?
The orbit of Mars, the orbit of almost all the planets, are very close to a plane. So I don't know the exact number. Maybe Paul does. If Paul told us that Mars's orbit is tilted 5 degrees compared to the Earth's orbit, I'd believe it. Maybe you're also asking what's the tilt of the axis of Mars, so you know how severe the summer versus the winter is. What was that again?
Yes, the axis of Mars is what I was inquiring about.
So, Paul, maybe you know the axis of Mars. I don't think it's too different from the Earth, but Spirit and Opportunity, because they were solar powered, in their Mars winter when the sun didn't rise per se, not very much, and it got super cold, I think you were saying they went off to one side and rusted. I think you could say that they hibernated. Spirit and Opportunity had to hibernate. But I'm guessing that Curiosity, with its nuclear power, doesn't have to hibernate in the wintertime. So there's two sets of questions there. Does Curiosity work even in the winter? I think it can. Maybe a limited number of experiments, but I'll bet you it works through the Mars winter. And is the inclination of Mars's axis similar to the Earth's inclination? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I think it's 24 degrees. I know it's very similar. Without looking up, I'll say 24 degrees. Well, I think we're what, 22 and a half? So, with the RTG, if you had enough, let's say, another RTG on board, you might be able to run Curiosity at night, but they don't run it at night. It's constantly putting out power, so it's really charging there. I think they have 55 amp hour batteries, a couple of them on board. So they have to keep these things charged. They do kind of take off at night, but they don't have to. And they can work all year long. And they do work all, they've been up since, August 2012, driving around. The solar power ones, 18 move. Back to you, Dick.
So Curiosity doesn't operate at nighttime. Charges batteries during the daytime. By the way, just to show you how temperature can be really wicked, as close as the moon is, I don't know the exact number, but I vaguely remember moon goes from minus 150 to plus 150 centigrade day to night, and that day is 28 days long, Earth days long. But minus 150 centigrade, if that's roughly the number, that's approximately 230 negative Fahrenheit, 230 degrees below zero Fahrenheit on the moon at nighttime. And plus 150 centigrade, if that was the right number, it's plus 300 degrees Fahrenheit. So in the daytime, it's an oven to be used to cook a turkey in a couple of hours. At nighttime, you would freeze almost anything. So living with human beings on the surface of the moon would be really tough. I think the average temperature on Mars is something like 20 degrees. No, no. 20 degrees centigrade might be the average temperature on the moon, but the extremes are huge. I think the average temperature on Mars is pretty darn cold. I think on high noon at the hottest place on Mars, I think you get up to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. But I think almost all the other time you're well below zero. So that portion of the Martian really didn't show him surviving super cold weather. He wasn't anywhere near insulated well enough. And he also wasn't protected as far as... Let me drop. I didn't see anywhere near enough protection for him as far as air pressure on the inside of his suit versus almost zero air pressure outside. Mars is getting rather close to being a vacuum. The air pressure there is so low. So, what was I going to ask you? Ready. So, don't use the Curiosity at night. And I guess part of that... By the way, that is what I was going to ask you. Does Curiosity have any major failures? I mean, Spirit and Opportunity have had wheel failures and whatever. Certainly Spirit had the wheel failure, which eventually put it out of business. But I seem to remember that there was either a acoustic sensor or a temperature sensor on the mast of Curiosity that did fail. So therefore, measuring the wind whistle or wind temperature, I think, was a failed experiment. But it sounds like the rest of it is cranking. Wasn't there a little bit of a breakup of some of the surface of the wheels? So what failures have we had on Curiosity, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW?
I think they need like 1,500 watts operation during the day, and since this thing only produces 103 watts, they need to not operate at night, and naturally the 100 watts keeps charging the batteries, and this way they have, you know, the batteries will be full in the morning. I guess if they overdid it with the arm, they have the arm that comes off. That's doing a lot of work. Or if they're doing a lot of driving, they could rest a couple of days, and you know, if the battery's low. So no problem with that. Trying to think of the other. Oh yeah, the failures. Yeah, I know the weather system was built by Spain. Spain's contribution to the rover. They had one little failure with that, and they also had a failure on one of the other rovers early on. But yeah, that's apparently no big deal. The holes, there's holes that they didn't expect in the wheels of Curiosity. Let me drop it. They didn't see the holes in the other rovers. They were light, you know, they were about 400 pounds on Earth. And this thing's about 2,000 pounds on Earth. And since Mars is 0.38, of the gravity that we have, you can do the math, one third. But it's enough to... put holes if they're driving on rough ground into the wheels of Curiosity. velocity, so now they, when they plan on going wherever they're going, they make sure they don't go through this very rough terrain. They go around it the best they can. And they know where they're going from the 17 cameras that are on board Curiosity, and also from extremely good pictures from the high-rise camera on MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's going around. They have a good idea where they're going before they get there. Their goal is to eventually drive up Mount Sharp. They're in Gale Crater, and the idea is to continue going up Mount Sharp when we drop. The one thing I don't understand, I keep forgetting about it, but I always want to ask, geology tends to get away from me. They keep saying on the reports that I read, or some of the ones I've actually, you watch some of the videos from NASA, they talk about the rover going up Mount Sharp. I know that's the goal to do that. You know, it's kind of like in a valley now, and it's working its way up slowly but surely. They keep saying as they go higher onto Mount Sharp, Mount Sharp is about 3 miles high if you were standing there. So it's a big mountain. But the higher you go up, the further back in time you're going. I thought it would have been the other way around. So anybody into geology could answer that. I'd like to hear that. But I'm more interested in the engineering and the mechanics behind these things than the geology. But that kind of throws me every time I hear it. Back to you, WS to
end. Yeah, I'm with you, Paul. Higher up, back in time, sounds backwards. Unless the mountain got there by way of very deep material being poked up high by way of subduction plate tectonics, whatever, doesn't sound right. On Earth, the deeper down you dig, the further back in time you're going, in many places, maybe most. So Mars is simply built upside down. Isn't that true, John? TC2WGB, T2IW.
Well, no, Dick, it's inside out. That's what happened. They took that ball and turned it inside out. Don't forget, our mountain range is now, the archaeologists and the geologists are finding that there are fossil remains there from the sea. So it came out of, just as you said, as plate tectonics took place, it pushed it up, and it was underwater at one time, and now they're thousands of feet high. So why wouldn't it be the same on Mars? Sounds right. I don't know if you've seen those things, but they're really into that. Back to you, Dick.
Can I go back far enough in time? Nothing is constant. You got tropical plants as fossils in Alaska, and so you're saying that early deep-sea life is now being discovered on the top of some of the mountains. Do you happen to know which mountain had that characteristic, John?
There were several ranges in America. I believe the Rockies were one of them. There's also in the Middle East, they found them. But it seems that wherever they probe on these mountaintops, now, of course, the Alps, I don't know, because they're fairly new, as you can tell by the sharp points they have. But even there's probably going to be some artifacts from millions and millions of years ago that were pushed up from the floor. So it's probably everywhere standard.
Now, the mathematics of how many planets, how many stars, the observable universe, big numbers. Each galaxy has got something like 10 to the 11 stars, and there are 10 to the 11 observable galaxies, rough numbers. You get 10 to the 22 stars in the observable universe. Big number. And the best thinking right now is that the universe is 13.7, 13.8 billion years since Big Bang. You could say it's 13.8 billion years old. Okay? The mathematics of that and the mathematics of playing cards, a deck with 52 cards, all of a sudden, you'll be amazed at the relationship between the two. So I'm going to start off with a simple sounding question. You've played cards a few times in your life, John. You've shuffled the cards. Assuming you did a good job of shuffling the cards, make a guess. Roughly how many times do you think the shuffled deck of cards arrangement today as opposed to some other day that you shuffle those cards? Roughly how many times do you think you shuffled the deck of cards and the two shufflings ended up the same? At some some period of time between them. KC2WGB, K2IW.
I'm not sure, Dick. I don't have a clue, but I would imagine I couldn't do it in my lifetime.
What makes you say that? You wouldn't be able to shuffle the cards. Let's assume you shuffled the cards every couple of seconds. And by some means you could instantaneously record where all the cards are arranged. You're telling me that in your lifetime you would never have two deck arrangements that are identical? Over to you, John.
Yeah, I believe it would be very, very rare in my estimation, off the top of my head. I don't think you could do it. And one deck, of course, I'm talking about. Not sure. I guess you could figure it out and calculate it. It's possible, but I can't.
I agree with John on that one, Dick.
Where did you get that information, Paul? What makes you think that you've never had two decks arranged the same way that you have properly shuffled them? Over to you, Paul.
From what I listened to John, you've got 52 cards. So let's say you have, each one is a number. You could have that arranged, 1 through 9, and then after 9, we live on the decimal system, so it's 10 numbers. We would need, I wonder what it would be called for 52 numbers. So the next one would have to be A, B, C, D, And now you could arrange these in an infinite amount of locations. You could take the card number M out and replace that with card number 5, put 5 where M is, and you do that a couple of times, you're never gonna, it would be like dialing the your telephone number, and then somewhere along the line, pick that same number out of the hat, see if you could dial that same number again. Back to you.
Well, Dick, permutations probably could be calculated. I think it's going to be a high number. But look at it this way. If you took 10 cards, and how many times would you have to shuffle them before you'd wind up with the same arrangement? And then multiply that by a factor, and it gets to be very high numbers in my estimation. Maybe you've got an answer. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
52 factorial, and what's your age?
Get that man a cigar. Yeah, I found a website that went through this, and Lou is right on target on this one. You got 52 cards in the deck. The fact that we call some of them numbers and some of them picture cards and so on doesn't matter. There's 52 unique cards by way of your clubs, hearts, diamonds and spades, and numbers and pictures. 52 unique cards. So if you're laying out a deck, the very first card you lay on the table, you got 52 choices. The next card you put on top of it, you got 51 choices. The next card you put on top of that, you got 50 choices, and so on. So 52, 51, 50, 49, 48, all multiplied together all the way down to 1. That's 52 factorial. 52 factorial is the number 8, and if I round it off to the nearest, most significant figure, 8 followed by 67 zeros. 8 times 10 to the 67. Okay, that's a big number. How big is that number? That's how many possible arrangements of a deck of cards. 8 times 10 to the 67. Okay. The website I told me the following. Let me drop it. Assume that I could shuffle the cards once every second. Of course you can. But I do a thorough shuffling of cards once every second. And I do it for the whole life of the universe. 13.8 billion years. Next question is, how many seconds, if you're doing one shuffling every second, and by some magic you're recording exactly, by some kind of a computer, you're recording where the arrangement of all the cards are on each one of these 1 second shuffles. 13.8 billion years is 10 to the 17 seconds. If you get 10 to the 17 seconds in the life of this 67 is the number of shuttles. 10 to the 17 is the number of seconds in the whole darn universe from Big Bang till now. Subtract 17 from 67, you're left with 50. That means you could take one shuffle every single second for the whole life of the universe and count the number of shuffles. You would not equal the number of shuffles that are possible by 10 to the 50. You're lacking 10. You could do the life of the universe 10 to the 50 times. So the chances are, if you've done a fair shuffle, no human being on planet Earth has never seen the same deck of cards shuffled the same way. 10 to the 67 is such a big number. How big is that number? Another way of looking at it. One of my smart buddies, who used to like big numbers, one of the consulting engineers we had at AIL, estimated that the total number of molecules, total number of atoms in the universe is 10 to the 70. 10 to the 70 molecules in the whole darn universe. Is it atoms or molecules? I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. 10 to the 7 molecules of all of the 10 to the 22 stars and all of their planets. And you got 10 to the 67 shuffles. So a very simple object, a deck of cards, the number of ways that that can be arranged, to call that astronomical is out of sight, way beyond. So probably no, as long as the shuffling was done fairly, without bias, you could say that no human being on Earth has ever shuffled a deck of cards and come up with an arrangement that any other human being on Earth has ever seen. Let's see how Lou thinks about that. NY2H, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
NY2H, well, if you think when you buy a deck of cards, I think it's ordered, you know, ace through the deuce, probably in each suit. And how often have you shuffled the deck and gotten that same pattern?
Well, there's shuffling and there's shuffling, Lou. To really do a completely random shuffle, the way you, what do they call it, ripping cards together, you know, the way that you flip your thumb across the right hand and left hand, you split the deck into two separate pieces, and now you're folding them together. And to do that operation 8 times is not as random as you think it is. There are more randomizing techniques. So the way we shuffle is very deficient. But if we really did a completely fair, thoroughly random shuffle, no two human beings on planet Earth have ever had the same arrangement of cards, you could make that assessment based on the fact that doing it once every second for the whole life of the universe, you'd have to do that procedure 10 to the 50 times before you have used up all possibilities. How do you lose? If the 10 to the 70 molecules in the universe and 10 and 52 factorial is 10 to the 67, very close. And by the way, that's not counting the jokers. I think there's two jokers in a deck also. Isn't that true, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW?
That system sounds like a lottery system.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so that would make it 54 factorial. So take 54 times 53 and take that number and times it by your answer. And now we've got a little bit more time we'd have to spend if the universe will last that long.
So when it comes to randomization, something as simple as 52 pieces of cardboard gives you a little bit of a clue as to how random Mother Nature can be when it comes to molecules. When you've got Avogadro's number of molecules in a volume of gas, I mean, if you take the air in the atmosphere and you take Avogadro's number of it, it's roughly 1 cubic foot of air, a little bit less than 1 cubic foot of air. Avogadro's number is 10 to the 23rd, I think, 6.023, 10 to the 23rd. How many possible ways of arranging 10 to the 23rd molecules of a cubic foot of air when just 52 cards is 10 to the 67 possible arrangements? I think you could say that this is the most random of all possible universes, with occasionally a couple of places that randomness results in life forming. I mean, not the Penzias Wilson, I can't think of the guy's name, but Yuri somebody other experiment where he took the...
Miller.
That's it, Yuri Miller, I keep forgetting that. The Yuri Miller experiment shows you that the randomization of just boiling some water in a flask and passing a spark through it and starting off with, you think of some of the raw materials that were on the Earth a zillion years ago, 4.5 billion years ago, and you look at that soup you get at the end, and you've got the 23 amino acids, you've got the 13 of them you can recognize right away, and when they went back and reviewed his material, they found quite a few more with modern day instrumentation. Craziness. Does that mean we've got it all figured out, Lou? What do you think? SY2HK2IW?
Gee, I don't know. But, we could be the product of a random... Well, but it's repeatable, right? And, I was looking at the Google News, and they were talking about the Drake equation again, and apparently they're redoubling their feelings on ancient civilizations, and just very quickly looking at it, it seems like they're saying that there probably have been many civilizations that are by now extinct. I don't know why they're saying that, but so it's all fascinating stuff.
WS2N, I want to make one comment before it got later, Dick.
You got it, Paul.
I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the podcast the doctor is in. I know everybody probably got the email on it. I did listen to it, and it was pretty good, by the way. So, that's the same fellow, W1ZR, Joel, that writes in the QSD. It was actually pretty good. I listened to the first episode. It was about a half hour long, a little less than that. Back to you, Dick.
Y2JJ.
Mr. JJ, go right ahead. Start up with your full call and name, sir. KQRIW.
Well, it's NY2JJ, New York, to Juliet, Juliet. Name is John. You're neglecting the possibility that you could actually duplicate your shuffle on the second try. You don't have to exhaust all the possibilities before you recycle.
Okay, John, if you did a thoroughly random shuffle, if you did a really fair shuffle, which takes a whole lot of simple shuffles that we do, if you did a really fair shuffle, and there's 10 to the 67 possible ways of arranging cards, I'm going to ask you, John, what is the probability that your second shuffle is identical to the first shuffle if there's 10 to the 67 possibilities? NY2JJ, K2RAW.
It's the same as it was low voltage.
It's just the same. What does that mean? In other words, the fact that I shuffled doesn't matter. I start off with a deck of cards in a certain arrangement, and then I shuffle them, and I've got the exact same arrangement. Is that what you're saying, John?
The shuffle has the exact same probability of low voltage.
NY2H.
Go ahead, Lou.
Yeah, any of those many sequences are equally probabilistic, that's for sure. You won't have to wait a full round before you see the same sequence again. It's like when you have 20 people in a room and you ask what their birthdays are, and often you have two people that have the same birthday, even though you don't have 365 or 66 people in the room.
Yeah, birthday is a different situation. If you and I have a deck of cards on the table in front of us, Lou, and we find out that they're in some particular order, and you do a real good job of shuffling them, you're saying there's a good chance that after they're shuffled, they're in the same arrangement they were before we started? Is that what you're saying, Lou?
No. What I'm saying is, whatever that time period was, which apparently we haven't even exhausted that amount of time yet in our known universe, but whatever that time period is, let's go halfway, for example. So cut that time period by one half. And, you know, at that point you might see a repeat. In other words, you don't have to wait. I think what he's saying is you don't have to wait the full cycle. And again, you know, because it's equally probabilistic, it's improbable that you would wait a full cycle to have it repeated. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen way up front either, you know. Although it could. You know, it certainly could. But it's improbable that it would. So, and it's also improbable that you'd have to wait the full period. So I would say, like, if you think about going to half the period, it's almost like a bell curve. It might be more probable then. Although that might not be true, but hopefully you're getting the gist of what I'm saying.
I hear what you're saying, Lou, but now I'm going to hit you with a specific. I believe you're enough of a scientist that you've got some familiarity with exponential mathematics. The total number of arrangements of 52 cards that are possible is 10 to the 67 power. The total number of seconds in the universe as we know it is 10 to the 17. Now, here's the question, Lou. What is the ratio between 10 to the 67 and 10 to the 17? If you divide one into the other, what do you get as an answer? Over to you, Lou, K2RIW.
10 to the 50, I believe, which is enormous. But I'm not saying 10 to the 70. I'm saying 10 to the 67. Forget about the age of the universe. Just think about how long it would take to go through each of those sequences before you'd get a repeatable, or at least, so, you know, so if you wanted each one, but because they're equally probabilistic, they're not going to be distributed one for one for one for one. You might get five of one and none of another for the period of 10 to the 67. You go out further in time, then you might get the others.
There's a degree of truth in what you've said, Lou, and a degree of non-truth. In the case of binary signals, if I've got a whole sequence of signals that looks like a bunch of ones and zeros, when you really put it all together, it might be 16 QAM or 64 QAM or MIMO or some other kind of complicated signal. But if I have a thoroughly random signal made of ones and zeros, when you're doing testing of that signal through a piece of electronics, like an amplifier that's got capacitive coupling between the stages, and it's got the right kind of a machine that really simulates that signal. Even though the signal itself is a gold code, which means that in the long run, the average number of ones and the average numbers of zeros is equal to each other. However, you run that machine and you'll find out once in a while, you get 35 ones in a row, or 50 zeros in a row, even though it's thoroughly random, even though the total number of ones and zeros in a long period of time, because it's a gold code, is equal. That's just simple binary mathematics. One and zero, only two states. And you're talking about all possible words you can make out of those two states. And now you've got 52 states, as far as the individual number of elements of this deck of cards. Let me drop. You did it correctly. If I take 10 to the 17 seconds, the whole life of the universe, in seconds, divide it into 10 to the 67, total number of states of a deck of cards, you end up with 10 to the 50. That means I could do the experiment of the whole life of the universe, 10 to the 17 seconds. I can do it 10 to the 50 times before I've exhausted all possibilities of the number of arrangements of cards. If you look at it from that point of view, if you've done a fair enough shuffling job, you're never going to see the same arrangements of cards in your lifetime. Over to you, Lou, NY2A. That's what the mathematics suggests, K2RIW.
NY2A. Well, an individual's lifetime would be 10 to the X seconds. I don't know what X is, but it's probably a lot lower than anything that we've talked about so far.
There's 10 to the 7 seconds per year. Pi times 10 to the 7 seconds per year. And assuming I'm going to live 100 years, I'm going to be very complimentary here. 10 to the 7, so I'm going to live pi times 10 to the 9 seconds is my total life if I live to 100. 10 to the 9 seconds. 10 to the 17 in the universe, and we got this 10 to the 50 left over if I compare number of seconds in the universe versus number of arrangements of cards. Another way of looking at this, you've got some huge number of molecules in a human being, whether 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14. You and I have watched Star Trek, in which that machine beams you down, takes all those molecules apart, sends them electronically, and reconstructs them on the other end. What's the chances of getting 10 to the 14 molecules of a human being with all of the complication of all the DNA strands and everything else, getting that all back together on the other end? We can dream about beaming down. Nice science fiction. Not a chance in the world, is my guess. NY2HK2IW.
Yeah, the other fallacy is when you give the binary example, the ones and zeros, they're replaceable, but when you do the deck of cards, you can say it's base 52, but once you exhaust one, you don't repeat it. So you're limited to a sequence of 52 entities, and each one is unique. So it differs a little bit from the binary example.
It sure does. Very fooling mathematics. Similar to, we've all read these puzzles where somebody says, I'm going to fill up all the squares of a tic-tac-toe, of a checkerboard. I think there's 64 squares on a checkerboard. I'm going to give you 1 grain of rice on the first one and 2 grains of rice on the second one. Or I'm going to give you 1 penny on the first one and 2 pennies on the second. So you're taking 2 and raising it to the 64 power. A huge number. So it sounds simple, but once you get into exponential mathematics, it gets big real fast. I don't think you could put 1 grain of sand on the first square of a checkerboard and then and double it on each individual square. There might not be enough grains of sand on the Earth to do that. I've had you, Lou. Did you always ever...
No, there probably isn't. So anyway, there's a guy out there, his name is Stephen Greer. He's an emergency room doctor, but he heads this thing he calls the Disclosure Project. And his claim is that, and he's got a bunch of witnesses from government, military, you know, about contact with the aliens. So I don't know, I'm still trying to get a handle on this guy. But it is compelling watching. He's all over YouTube. He's got a couple of websites. Dr. Stephen Greer, G-R-E-E-R.
Yeah, he's got about 10 different YouTube videos. One of them, one of the 10 I just happened to hit on, which runs for about an hour and 20 minutes, and I listened to it. Boy, he sounds authoritative. He's giving you names and places and titles of real human beings. And at first you could say he's crazy and he wants sensationalism. You start digging into the specifics of what he's saying, it isn't too difficult to start believing it. Isn't that the impression you got, Lou? I mean, he doesn't sound like a nut. He's got a lot of education. He knows a hell of a lot of very important people in government, in multiple governments, and in classified projects and whatever. Area 51, he makes it sound like he visits them, you know, 5 times a year for the last 20 years, is the way he makes it sound. And that not even the president are fully informed on what we have really discovered in the field that you and I might call foreign technology. So he's hard to discount, isn't he, Lou? NY2H, K2IW. Somebody just said, that's absolutely right. I'm hearing a human being on the input. He doesn't...
I have to check myself because it is not... He said that the...
That human being, you need a PL tone.
Told him that we can send ET home. We've got the technology to send them home. And he asked him what he meant by that. And, well, that might have been on the video you've seen. I don't know. But he said a couple of things, and basically that, you know, all points in space and time are connected. And you can go forward and backward in time. And cetera. Very, very compelling, but you really have to, suspend your disbelief, I suppose. So anyway, but it's worth watching, I think. You know, and you're right, he names names. You know, it's amazing, and people come forward that have resumes within government, et cetera, from the military, and they have stories, and they tell them. And his, he says there's a shadow government that's suppressing a lot of this, that it's known, but it's not disclosed. So there you go.
Yeah, the way he worded it is that certain people can tolerate that kind of information. It doesn't drive them crazy. And if they're in the right position where they need to know, they're informed. But certain presidents, certain key government people could not tolerate that information. Their past history is such that their personality is too volatile or whatever, and they are intentionally not informed. Do you see a clearly defined motive for Stephen Greer? Is he trying to get us used to the fact that we're eventually all of this is going to be disclosed, and he's softly letting us in on it? I don't get the impression he is doing it just to be sensationalistic. I don't think he's making a fortune on what he's doing. There's a slim chance he's telling the truth. NY2H, K2RIW.
NY2H. Well, you know, he had a press conference at the National Press Club a few years ago, in which he presented some witnesses also. And each of these witnesses are willing to go before Congress and, swear under oath. Is he easing us into it? I don't know. And it's international. I mean, the other governments have released documents. The United States has not. It's got a tight lid on it. So I don't know. I'm going to look at some more of his stuff and try to figure it out. I watched the one film he had. It just became free on YouTube. And I was a little disenchanted at the end because he's saying, you know, you have Close Encounters. You know, we know the movie, The Third Kind, Let Me Let It Drop. So then I think a CE-4 is if you're actually on board one of the craft. So he's coined something called a CE-5, which is a human-initiated contact. And he goes out in the fields with people, and they meditate, whatever they do. And the movie gives you the impression that when they do that, all of a sudden you see a UFO or something in the sky, kind of responding to their, I guess they're sending out whatever. So, you know, I don't know. I kind of started to doubt things again when I saw that. But, yeah, with people listening to the TechNet, maybe you want to check him out, Stephen Greer. You know, draw your own conclusions. Back to net.
There was somebody I was hearing on the input who didn't have a PL oscillator turned on, therefore he wasn't coming through the machine. Who was that person? Want to make another transmission? K2RIW, give me your call letters. Okay, maybe he went away. From what you know right now, Lou, your first impression of Mr. Greer, what's the chances that he is accurate, truthful, versus he's crazy and he's just being sensationalistic? That's question number one. What do you think is the percentage in your mind that he's real and telling us the truth? That's question number one. And question number two, do you have the impression that he has had a close encounter of the third, fourth, fifth kind, whatever? Over to you, Lou, K2RIW.
NY2H. Well, one of the things that I learned in the movie is when he was young, he had a near-death experience. And, he described it typically as most do that have had that, you know, this kind of cosmicness, transcending Earth or what have you. And I wonder if if that left any kind of condition or not, put it gently. So I would say this. You know, I've been fooled before. Yeah, you look at these other people, these psychics, people that, you know, paranormal things, and, you know, sometimes I get sucked in, and then I say to myself, you know, come on, you know. So, try to keep an open mind, but I don't have any answers.
But here's one more question I got along those lines, though, Lou. He is naming some very specific people, showing very specific documents. Most of these people are still alive. Most of these people hold important positions. If all of what he's saying is a made-up story, would all of those people, knowing about his books, videos, and whatever, and presentations, would they tolerate that? Or wouldn't they show him to be a charlatan? Wouldn't they say, yeah, this is a big lie? How come they're so quiet? As I said, you and I have seen where he's naming some very important people, showing you some rather solid-sounding evidence. Would those people tolerate that if he was just making this all up? Over to you, Luke, KQRIW.
I mean, it's worldwide. All right, I'll turn it over to Joe in a second. You're right. You see, this is the problem. First of all, one of the problems is my own bias. I'd love for all this to be true. So I have to check myself anytime I'm, you know, invested that way. And you're right, what's so compelling about it are all these witnesses, all these people. So you're absolutely right, Dick. I have to agree with you on that. Joe?
And you guys are talking to me, Troy-wise. You guys are talking. I did put the name in Greer. It comes back to Stephen M. Greer. And there's like loads and loads of videos about him talking about all sorts of different stuff. You know, I find it more fascinating. I put K2RIW in on YouTube, and I get three different YouTubes, and the bottom one had pictures of three guys. The center guy looks like Dick with a cowboy hat on. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's real. I could tell you where the picture was taken. I could tell you who put the picture there. That was real. On top of that, if you Google the word evidence that NASA landed on the moon, if you Google those words, you'll find out that the K2RIW operation under my name, Richard Nadel, is listed as a piece of evidence that the astronauts really landed on the moon, because this character in Farmingdale, Long Island, set up some equipment and listened to the S-band signals from the moon directly. So if you Google proof that NASA really went to the moon, I am one of the references. Ain't that crazy, Joe? Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Not knowing it's coming from you, of course it's not crazy.
Okay, so, yeah, we got to look into this a little bit further, as I see it, Lou. He's a well-educated physician. Apparently, is he still practicing medicine? Is an interesting question. He's certainly going around giving a lot of lectures. I presume he's getting some kind of honorarium for giving these lectures. Somebody is paying him, I am guessing. Otherwise, why would there be so many hours of them with all kinds of witnesses and so on, and exact documents? It looks awful and real. I mean, I think by way of your work, you've done some work in classified work. You know what a classified document looks like. He's demonstrating an awful lot of what looks like typical U.S. government classified documents. That's something. Once again, John, we've gotten into cabbages and kings at the end of the TechNet. We go pretty far and wide. This was TechNet number 1,699. No. Yeah. No, 1,600. Sorry about that. The 1,600 TechNet. We'll be back next week. I don't think we can talk about wilder subjects than this, though, John. KC2WGB. K2IW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, fascinating subject, and there is so much information out there. It is hard to tell, you know, what's true and what isn't, and whether somebody has an agenda. But I'm going to have to check that out. I've never heard of him or seen any of his videos. But I'd like to thank everybody for joining us on the net tonight and for the questions that were sent in. If all goes well, we shall return next week. Same time, same repeater, and we'll have some more fun. be kind and enjoy the hobby. KC2WGB. Paul?
Yeah, John. John and Paul, you guys both have a homework assignment to do a little bit of listening of the Stephen Greer YouTube videos on the subject of extraterrestrials. WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Net, tonight, at...
Okay, I'm going to need a lot of proof. I'm always on the side of being very skeptical. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, so... I'll be on that side, but I will listen to him. I listen to any of this stuff. Very interesting. Back to you, Dick, and we'll catch you next week on the net, if not sooner. K2RIW, WS2N73, John. As well, you're still there.
And the smartest thing to do, Paul, is to be a skeptic. I think the skeptics are right a hell of a lot more of the time than the people that jump into things. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. See you next week.
NY2H, WS2N.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I had a question. If I wanted to get, I guess the word would be an endorsement or for an ISS, you know, contact through a school. I mean, who would I go to in the club, you know? I can't see bothering Joe with this, but, you know, I mean, who would approve something like that? Back to you, Will.
My first thought maybe is N2RQ, Lou, the other Lou. I know he does a lot with the school club roundup, and he deals with amateur radio and in schools, et cetera. He does a lot with Brooklyn Tech. And I think you're referring to the program where students contact the space station. So he may be a good start.
Yeah, maybe I'll email him. I still have his email here. If not, I have it in the roster. All right, very good. We'll do that. Yeah, the ARISS program, pretty cool. I've been following that on and off for years. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm sure something, if he's not involved directly, he'd be interested in also. And as I say, you know, he's got contacts and stuff. Yeah, it'd be very cool. And, yeah, let me know how that works out. And, trying to think of anybody else who might, but he's the first one that comes to mind. So I think he could help you out on that.
Yeah, I'm sure Ken too. He's involved with the, you know, he's the secretary. He knows everything about everything. I think I'll ask Ken on the computer that next time I talk to him. But very good. Okay, have a good night. Go before the repeated quiz. Have a very good night there. Lou N2RQWS. Correction. N2YHWS.
All right, Flo. Have a good evening. And, yeah, in terms of the club, if he's trying to get the club involved, yeah, Ken would be a good source, especially the secretary. So, very good. I enjoy, and catch an analog. WS2N and Y2H is clear. Good night.
Okay, yeah. I probably got another bit before the repeater quiz. My daughter, she's a ham too, so she teaches at one of the schools. She would like to do that, so we'll look into it. 73 again. Have a good night.
KB2PRU, KC2WGB. Nothing heard, KC2WGB clear.
This is Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Zulu Golf.
tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system. Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 2009, with the release of Friday, April 29, 2016, follow in 5, 4, 3, 2. The following is a QSC. Hams in the UK put patriotism on the air for St. George's Day. Australian licensees could be getting more power.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.